So if you remember where we left off yesterday, we started to talk about virya, which, as I mentioned, sometimes is translated as energy, but a more accurate translation is heroism. So virya is including this quite wide spectrum of qualities, which includes patience and fearlessness and perseverance and enthusiasm and passion. And of course, part of virya or energy falls within the wise efforts. Now, a very common sort of complaint, I might say, that I hear quite a bit, and I probably say it myself. Is that I don't, there seems to be a shortage of energy. I don't quite enough have enough energy to do what's required, or I don't have enough energy to practice, or I don't have enough energy to apply the path. Now I think this, as I mentioned yesterday, there is this thing called honest tiredness in our life, which sometimes it's just honest tiredness, and sometimes it does ask us to look at how we are living our life. But I think it's very good to really question this idea of a shortage of energy, as if we have this sort of limited reservoir, that then runs out. And where energy arises from. Because there's no doubt that it's a very genuine feeling that I don't have enough energy or I have a shortage of energy. I think a more interesting perspective is to look at how we use the energy that is available to us. And also whether we are looking at, really carefully looking at what actually is a source of energy in our lives. I mean, if you think of the kind of your experiences of sitting a retreat, I mean, the first few days, I mean, it's a very sorrowful sight, isn't it? You look around and you see, 70 people falling asleep collectively, and you think, how can you possibly be so tired, And if you think about what's happening on retreats, we're certainly not running marathons or digging ditches. We are essentially sitting around with the occasional little toddle in between, I mean, hardly major energy consuming. But look at what's going on in the mind in the background of that. How much kind of fantasy, preoccupation, proliferation, construction, obsession. And I would really like us to consider actually how much energy is required to support all of that. And how much energy that activity actually consumes. Now, this whole kind of direction of energy is very much in the light, really, of everything that we were also talking about yesterday, that energy, both its direction and its usage, is not attitudinally neutral, that again, it is either wholesome or unwholesome, or, and again, remember how we looked at those words yesterday as being kusala or ennobling or akusala, something that actually sort of diminishes or minimizes a sense of possibility. If you think about when, if you've ever been gripped by a major craving attack. There's no shortage of energy, is there? I mean, it just seems to arise. If you've ever been gripped by a major aversion attack, you know, can be an enormous amount of energy suddenly seems to be available to avoid something we really don't want to be with. So energy, when it is disconnected from discernment, and remember we talked about this in investigation, about how wise discernment is part of investigation. When energy is disconnected from discernment, I think it becomes a very randomly available resource to us. You know, because we will put enormous energy, for example, perhaps into some obsession or preoccupation, and then think somehow we should come to sit. And again, if we come to practice, if the interest level is not there, there's no energy. I mean, I think that's a simple reality in practice, that if there is no interest, there will be very, very limited energy. But also be aware of how sometimes the interest factor in itself is being veiled by the hindrances. Right? So it's not a straightforward picture. Huh? It's not at all a straightforward picture. So it's actually a very, very good question to ask, first of all, where does energy arise from? How is energy being employed or directed in our life? How is it being focused? And if there are these kind of, you know, falls into these sort of deflated sense of weariness, you know, of fatigue of energy, not physical fatigue, but much more psychological fatigue or emotional fatigue, then I think it is really important to really examine carefully, to investigate how we are using the energy that is available to us, and if it's really contributing to well-being or if it is really detracting from well-being. It is so important for us to acknowledge, as we talked about yesterday with things not having an independent self-existence, it is so important to acknowledge this also applies to thought. It applies to obsession. It applies to preoccupation. They do not have an independent self-existence. So any of that kind of entanglement of mind is actually being supported by the energy that is being fed into it. That any of that kind of entangled activity of mind is being supported by the energy that is being fed into it. Part of wise energy, of course, does include the whole dimension of wise effort. You know, and in my experience, we usually learn about wise effort through unwise effort. You know, and I'm not convinced that there is a shortcut to wise effort. You know, we're either going to learn about wise effort through the effects of striving or overambitiousness, or we're going to learn about wise effort through the opposite extremes of a sort of inertia or ambivalence or, you know, lack of dedication. But I want to touch briefly upon the four wise efforts, because I think this is a significant part of virya, a significant part of energy. And I'm sure that some of this is really quite familiar territory to you. However, that doesn't stop me from touching on. I make no apology for repetition in this teaching. It's a teaching of endless repetition, you know. So, you know, there's a point here. You're supposed to actually have things repeated to you often enough that you actually start saying, okay, I'm either going to learn this or this is going to be my sort of life sentence, you know. Prevent the arising of the unwholesome that has not already arisen. It's an interesting one, isn't it? First of all, you have to know what is unwholesome, what is unhelpful, what is unskillful. You have to know this through the landscape of your own experience. And usually when we talk about the unwholesome, again, this is such a difficult word, but the diminishing, the unhelpful, the unskillful, we would usually be looking at some of our psychological and emotional habit patterns where we know they always end up in the same place. There is no different outcome, you know. Whether it is, you know, and certainly, you know, I think the Buddhist tradition is very, very skilled at sort of defining the unskillful, you know, from aversion to fantasy to proliferation, anything that takes us away or that takes us into a state of argument with the way things are, that disconnects us, that actually leads to a diminishment of the heart's potential, is unskillful. So preventing the arising of the unwholesome or unskillful that hasn't already arisen, whatever it is that we know in our minds that leads to distress and that leads to suffering. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, you know, there's some kind of rather crude examples, you know. For example, you wouldn't really anticipate that a sort of ethical state of mind was going to survive an orgy. So you wouldn't go there. You know? If you have addictive patterns, it's best not to be in conditions that stimulate and trigger those addictive patterns. But I think it's much more subtle than that often within ourselves. And, you know, the antidote in our lives, you know, the antidote certainly in this teaching to prevent the arising of the unwholesome that's not already arisen is to cultivate the wholesome, to stay very much connected with, you know, the Dharma, with good friends, with stillness, with clarity, with knowing what we're doing, with how we're living our life, essentially. You know, there is much that can incline our minds to the unwholesome, you know, whether it's, you know, you have to look at how we're using our time, what we're doing with our attention. Is it opening the door to that which is unskillful, which is unwholesome to arise? I think, you know, sometimes there's a price to pay in waking up. I don't know if you've found that. I've found that, you know. There's a price to pay in waking up in the sense of letting go of that which offers sometimes temporary pleasure. And be careful here, because this is not a downer on pleasure. Huh? But sometimes being aware of how we can try to fill our lives with temporary gratifications in order to avoid being with what is. I think the price to pay in waking up is often in terms of simplifying our lives, and is often in terms of simplifying what we're paying attention to all the time. You know, I think sometimes it's about making wise choices and wise discernment, you know. Maybe it's actually, you know, I come home from work, you know, rather than turning on the TV, maybe it's better I spend 10 minutes looking at the trees. You know, it's actually, you know, sometimes that kind of basic, you know, how am I preventing the arising of the unwholesome, which is basically heedlessness. It's what makes us heedless, you know, makes us forgetful. The second of the wise efforts, of course, this aspect of energy is to abandon the unwholesome that has already arisen. Okay, so sometimes how do we abandon? You know, it's interesting how much this word abandon is used in the discourses, that the Buddha was not afraid of a little muscle. You know, I very much honor how much of this practice, how much of this path really emphasizes kindness and compassion and gentleness. But I think it's not helpful to delude ourselves to thinking that that is only the kind of effort that is spoken about. You know, the Buddha certainly has no allergy to a little bit of muscle, a little bit of clear resolve. Have you noticed how intractable some of our habit patterns are? And that sometimes now they're just habits. You know, no more insight to be squeezed out, no more juice in it, no more learning, now just a habit pattern. So abandoning the wholesome that's already arisen, sometimes by investigation. You know, how do I know that this is unwholesome? Okay, so say my mind is involved in some sort of big sort of a vendetta against somebody or against myself. How do I know it's unwholesome? Well, look at your body. Look at your mind. What is the effect? What is the consequence? What is the residue? It's not, this is not, you know, sort of like just labeling something unwholesome. It's very important to have the felt sense of what happens when we entertain the akusala, or the unwholesome. The felt sense, you can feel that diminishment of the heart's potential. So sometimes by investigation, knowing the landscape and the consequence of the unskillful, I'm going to use the word akusala because I think it's, somehow to get a sense of this, the not noble, the diminishing, the degrading, the limiting. I think it's a better word than unwholesome, to get a felt sense of that. So get a felt sense of what the akusala feels like, what blame and shaming and, judging or, what it feels like. It's not a place of happiness. It's not a place of happiness. It's not a place of well-being. It's not a place of contentment. It's a place of distress, And I think letting go is not something that happens because we shout at ourselves to let go. I'm actually pretty sure that I have never let go of anything in my whole life. I have never let go of anything in my whole life. I think what we do in the practice, try shouting at yourself to let go of something. Has anybody ever been that successful? Sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? I should just let go of this. Who? What we do in practice, of course, is we cultivate the conditions that allows for letting go to happen. Investigation, insight, understanding, compassion, spaciousness, we cultivate the conditions that allows letting go to occur. Rather than me somehow deluding myself to feeling that I'm in charge of letting go and then feeling such a failure when I'm unsuccessful. And sometimes our energy is going in the wrong place. But abandoning the akusala, the unskillful that has already arisen, well, sometimes investigation, have the felt sense of the akusala, the unhappiness of it, the distress of it. Then actually we're really encouraged to cultivate the conditions that allows letting go to happen. Sometimes it's reflection, the abandonment of the akusala that's already risen, to reflect upon the consequences. Where does this go? If I see perhaps a little bit of an open door of an invitation to engage together with someone in a big sort of gossip attack, whatever, reflect on where that goes. Reflect upon the consequences. And again, really being aware that reflection is not about judgment, it's not about right. It's actually knowing for ourselves what kind of pathway we are cultivating in that moment and what kind of habit pattern or neural rut we are deepening and whether it's one we actually really want to deepen. So being aware of consequences, being aware, if you plant again, a pear seed, you're not going to get an apple. You're going to get a pear. If you plant the seeds of aversion, you're going to get aversive consequences. Abandoning the unwholesome that has already arisen is sometimes a committed restraint. Say you can see, some of those familiar thought patterns, that preoccupations or obsessions or judgments or, whatever it is, you can start to feel the surge. Sometimes there is a committed restraint. It's a little bit, we talked about this yesterday, the withdrawal of consent in participating in something that does not lead to well-being. And sometimes that really is a committed restraint in relationship. It means sometimes it's a committed restraint about how we're using our sense doors even. You know, if I know that I have a sort of tendency towards, you know, greed-based proliferation, well, actually, you know, if I'm walking down the street, I might be really looking at what I'm doing with my eyes, my ears, you know. Am I sort of prowling the world for something to sort of excite me? You know, or am I actually finding a different kind of groundedness? The committed restraint might be in a sort of arising of one of those familiar thought patterns, you know. We don't feed it. We don't feed it. Maybe we come back to something that is much more tangible, more available to us as a place to rest our attention. Maybe we come back to being a bit more mindful of our body, or, you know, something that changes the focus of our attention. Not because that's bad or that's wrong, but because we know where it goes and we know it's not helpful. And sometimes, you know, committed restraint or, you know, this little bit of muscle in the practice, I don't think we should be afraid of it, you know. It's different than sort of suppression. It's different than, you know, pushing away. It's forcing. Committed restraint or a little bit of muscle in the practice really has to be built upon our own inner discernment and understanding experientially of what leads to suffering and what leads to the end of suffering. If it doesn't have that discernment, then it is true that a little muscle in the practice can just be another form of aversion, which is unhelpful. But if it's rooted in discernment, you know, I don't think we should be afraid. You know, in fact, you know, like when the Buddha talks, like in some of the discourses, about working with the intractable and some of these most deeply embedded habit patterns, you know, he goes through this long list of responses, you know, from investigation to cultivating the qualities that are not present, you know, that are absent, to reflecting on the consequences, to, you know, shifting the focus of your attention. And then he gets into this piece, you know, with your tongue pressed about against the roof of your mouth, do not go there. You know, do not go there. And, you know, the very last one is, of course, ask for help. You know, but there's certainly this mention of a little resolve. In a few of the suttas, you know, the Buddha describes liberation as the freedom from residues. The heart and the mind that is free from residues. And if we look at what residues are usually born of engaging in unwise attention. You know, then we get the thoughts of, I wish, you know, I really wish I hadn't gone there, you know, or, you know, I wish I hadn't said that, regret, remorse, you know, guilt, embarrassment, shame. It's all kind of pointing back to somewhere our actions and our efforts were divorced from discernment, you know. And in cultivating kind of wise discernment and understanding, you know, the intention is actually to liberate the heart from residues. That stuff that, like styrofoam cups, it just swims around forever. The third of the wise efforts is to arouse the kusala, arouse the wholesome that has not already arisen. Now, again, as I mentioned yesterday, the whole translation of bhavana for meditation is to cultivate, to bring into being. We are not waiting for some mysterious kind of blessing to fall from the heavens. You know, what actually comes into being in your life and in your practice is what you have cultivated. And this is a path of cultivation. It's learning to love stillness. It's again coming back, what do we value? how much do we value kindness? How much do we value spaciousness? How much do we value compassion? How much do we value simplicity? If we value that, that is what we cultivate. What we cultivate grows. You know, one of my favorite sayings from the Buddhist teaching is, what you dwell upon becomes the shape of your mind. And very often the shape of your mind becomes the shape of your world, doesn't it? That what we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. So there is this incredible encouragement in the practice to keep coming back, and I don't want to sound Pollyanna-ish here, but to keep coming back to goodness, the goodness of the heart. You know, the goodness, the kusala, qualities of the heart. You know, the heart's potential, the seeds that live within us for empathy and compassion and kindness and stillness and spaciousness and clarity, to actually, I have to say, begin to fall in love with being aware far more than we're in love with being asleep. You know, to begin to fall in love with being awake far more than we might be infatuated with being preoccupied or obsessive. And so you need to have the taste of that, don't you? I mean, it's really so important that we have a taste of what it, you know, the moments in our lives when we have really felt that sense of wakefulness or that genuine sense of stillness or empathy or generosity, to really savor the taste of that. Because that is, again, what we are building on. That is what we are cultivating. That is what we have confidence in. That is what we have trust in. And we also have confidence in our capacity to cultivate that and to bring it into being. And that leads very much into, you know, the fourth of the wise efforts, which is to sustain and to deepen the wholesome or the kusala that has already arisen. And I referred to this yesterday about how easily, certainly, I think culturally, we are imperfection-centered. You know, it has much to do with the sort of ideology of the perfect self. It tends to incline the mind towards being imperfection-centered. What is wrong with me, what I did wrong, where I blew it, where I am not good enough, where I haven't done well enough, all the places I have failed. But that is in itself a kind of toxic pattern of mind. I think it's really important to notice that. It's the kind of entertainment of self-aversion. Very different than discernment, you know, because we do need to discern where actually we're not doing quite as well as we need to be doing. You know, and there are things that we need to learn and receive feedback and, you know, be able to hear criticism, you know, of where we have kind of blown it. That's very different than this mindset which is intent on the pursuit and the obsession about imperfection, because that mindset is not one that allows us to deepen and sustain the wholesome that is present within us. And, you know, again, there can be, again, this sort of fear of grasping, the fear of clinging. But think of how many moments are in a day, you know, where you do taste empathy or generosity or kindness or, you know, respect or compassion or calmness. Do we actually allow ourselves, and encourage ourselves to go there? Come to know the landscape of the kusala, because that will what is allow it to deepen. Now, in the Tibetan tradition, is something I'd like to, before I go into this, any questions on that piece? Any comments, reflections on that piece?
How do you spell
kusala? K-U-S-A-L-A, with a line over the last A. So one of the teachers, now long dead, that I really enjoy reading from the Tibetan tradition is a teacher called Patrul Rinpoche. And I just want to share with you a little bit some of the things, the ways that he talks about energy or effort. So he talks about three kinds of energy, three kinds of effort. One of them is armor-like energy. The other is energy in action. And the third is insatiable energy. Armor-like energy. I want to share with you just a few things that he said about this. Armor-like energy. He says, when you hear the stories of the lives of the great teachers and bodhisattvas, the deeds they did and the trials they went through, do not be discouraged. Never think that they were only capable of achieving what they did because they were Buddhas and you could never do the same. Remember that it was simply by acting in this way that they became so accomplished. We have all the freedoms and advantages of a human being. Now we have the opportunity to practice the Dharma. We should vow from the bottom of our hearts to do so, to be prepared to undertake austerities, take on burdens, and risk life and limb. This is what is meant by armor-like diligence and energy. It goes on. The second is energy in action. And this has something to do with translating what we value into how we live and how we practice. It has to do with this area that we spoke about yesterday of embodiment. How do we embody the practice? So Patrul Rinpoche says, do not spend your whole life telling yourself that you will practice one day, letting each day slip by. What we talked about yesterday about postponement practice. Death comes closer with every second. If you put off till tomorrow what could be done today, you will regret it on your deathbed. Devote yourself now, otherwise you will never find the time. Activities are just like ripples on the water. They only stop when you decide to end them. The preoccupations never end until the moment we die. They end when we put them down. Such is their nature. Let all of your actions be spurred by your understanding of impermanence. This is what is called diligence in action. And the third is insatiable diligence. Do not feel satisfied just at having done a little retreat or one or two good works. Vow to practice for as long as you live and determine to keep your efforts going with all the power of a great river until you are liberated. Try to make greater and greater efforts each day, never allowing body, speech, or mind to slip into idleness or to separate from the teachings for so much as an instant. To practice with greater tenacity the closer one gets to death is the mark of a Dharma practitioner who has not yet been caught by the frost. Thinking we do not need to practice proves that one needs to more than ever. And he ended with the words, moderate your eating, arrive at a balanced amount of sleep, make your efforts steady and constant, make your mind like a good bowstring, neither too loose nor too tight. It will get you nowhere to practice sporadically or only when you have time. So, that's energy, effort. Before we move on, is everyone done fully, clearly comprehending everything there is to comprehend about energy and effort? Yeah?
No. I have a question, and I'm having a little difficulty formulating it.
When I'm, you know, thinking about some of the stories of the great Tibetan masters and certainly others, it seems as though there was a new resource, an access to enormous amounts of energy in the practice. And so the concept that there's no independent fixed identity of energy, when you asked about what is the source, what, you know, the sense that it's losing, there's something that is interesting there.
Yeah.
Trying to get in touch with that.
Well, it is a question of what generates energy and what consumes energy. I do think we need to get away from this idea that we have some sort of fixed reservoir of energy that, you know, we need to carefully sort of ration, you know, because it's going to run out. I think if you again, you know, it ties in so much with what we were talking yesterday. I mean, you notice when you have a sort of passionate interest in something. It's, you don't feel like you have a limited reservoir of energy. It becomes generated. I mean, I see it on longer retreats when people are practicing more. There's more stillness. There's much more energy available. You know, the need for a number of hours of sleep goes down. You know, the effort level becomes much more effortless because there's more interest, there's more happiness. So it's actually, you know, what, I mean, unhappiness truly, I mean, distress truly does consume an enormous amount of energy. Okay? Happiness generates, and it's very interesting that happiness generates energy. I mean, it's not coming into some ideal view, you know, that we're never going to need to sleep or, you know, rest. It's nothing like that. But it is noticing really how much energy is to do with passion. I think it's to do with passion. What we have passion for, we have energy for. What we're interested in, we attend to. I mean, if you think perhaps about the first time you ever fell in love, probably nobody had to encourage you to stay awake. You know, there's passion, there's interest, there's energy. Seems almost boundless, doesn't it? So it's almost clarifying those pieces in our life, which I think really takes some reflection, but it's also seeing that, you know, you cannot have an intellectual passion for stillness, for example. You cannot have just an intellectual passion for joy or liberation. You know, one really needs to have actually the taste through one's own experience and practice, even just a little taste, to know that experientially as a real possibility and something that you fall in love with. Then there's energy. And, you know, in reality, it's very easy to get have these sort of very romantic images, you know, of yogis of the past, you know, bricked up in their Himalayan caves, you know, thinking it was all really easy for them. I really doubt it was. I really doubt it was. If you look at the universality of the human mind, if you read the discourses and what people were bringing to the Buddha 2,600 years ago, the same dilemmas, the same conflicts, the same struggles we have in our life, the timelessness of those questions of, you know, how to live in a fragile life, you know, how to live with the realities of loss and change, how to find a sense of direction. So it's not as if, you know, we are talking about sort of generations of people 2,600 years ago who have different minds than we have. Same minds. So it's very important not to romanticize those stories and think they only belong to generations of past yogis.
I'm a therapist, and I'm working with this 18-year-old young man who did really pretty awful things in his family. He's now living apart, and he has difficulty forgiving himself for what he did. He also talks on the phone with his mother in particular, who he wants to understand. She wants her to understand her part. And he also wants her to get help for herself. And basically his position is that she blows him off. And he leaves the conversations hurt, angry, depressed, wondering if he should have any relationship with her. And it seems like you're talking about all of this today, and you were yesterday in a way when the woman asked the question about the man who had abused her grandson. So I'm wondering if you can offer me any more clarity about how I might work with him.
Well, I think it's also you have to put yourself in his shoes, and how would you work with that situation? You know, given your understanding of the practice and the Dharma, how would you yourself work with that situation? I mean, probably what we have learned in our own practice is that we cannot force things like forgiveness or kindness or compassion. That there's a question of part of our discernment is timing. Sometimes we need space away from the difficult in order to recover enough inner resources to even consider things like forgiveness and compassion. You know, I think so often in our minds, especially when we've come out of very difficult situations or in the midst of very difficult situations, you know, of course we want to end the pain of it, but very quickly sometimes that gets translated in, how can I fix it? You know, so then we have the vocabulary, if I could forgive, it would be all right, you know, or if I could find more generosity, it would be all right. We're like 10 steps ahead of where we actually are in that desire to get away from the painful or to find a way to end that very human wish to end the pain. Isn't it? But we're actually about 10 steps ahead of where we are in that thinking. You know, and I see so often, you know, that people are too impatient to get to that place of the ending of the pain. And that maybe the patience and the energy is actually to say, okay, this is actually what's going on. There's tremendous sense of woundedness, disconnection. How do I tend to that, you know? I can't tend to everything too quickly, you know? How do I tend to renewing that sense of inner capacity, you know? That sense of you know, inner resources, of some steadiness and confidence and trust that I am approaching the difficult from that place. I mean, one of these wise efforts, you know, to avoid the unwholesome that has not already arisen, or abandon the unwholesome that has already arisen, I think we need to a little bit honor the possibility that there is something such as wise avoidance, both outwardly and inwardly. And to let go of this imperative, I think, that often gets kind of attached to mindfulness, where stay with, stay with, stay with becomes a sort of mantra of the day. It is unwise, in my experience, to adopt that imperative if the consequence of staying with means this continual, as you're saying about with this young man, this continual re-triggering of a sense of hurt and bewilderment and woundedness. It is sometimes wise avoidance is recognizing that actually we do need to take our attention away from that which is charged and difficult. It's saying not this, not now. It's not saying not this, not ever. You know, but certainly my experience of working in practice is that to get constantly overwhelmed is whittling away at confidence to the extent that it becomes very hard to recover. So sometimes it is better to just acknowledge, actually, this is not the time for me to deal with this, in this case, this external situation. internally it might be, this is not the right moment for me to be investigating this incredibly charged mental state or memory situation. Perhaps I just step away. It might be actually for a few moments. It might be for much longer. But what is that in the service of? The stepping away is not kind of blowing it off and saying, I'm never going to go there. It's actually saying, for me to approach this situation of incredible difficulty, pain and sorrow, I need to be approaching it not from a place of shatteredness and fragmentation, but from a place of some calmness and steadiness. It's simply bringing some discernment into that, and I think wise effort is part of that.
That's interesting, because he actually asked me the question of what I thought about him staying away. And I told him that kids his age often stay away until they come back.
Yeah.
But as you've been talking, I also thought, there's a piece about him in here, about what is so important to him. What is the meaning of his mother changing to him, not to her, to him. And that could be investigated.
That could be investigated, but it's always, the kind of litmus test here is really looking at where investigation turns into obsession. Of course the difficult or the confusing is always asking for investigation. But if that starts to slip into obsession, which is, just the repetition, the dead ends, the cul-de-sacs, that is the time to know that's also the time for wise avoidance. It's the time to step away from it, rather than to keep pounding at the door, for understanding is different than explanation. And somehow explanation never entirely satisfies us. Yeah. I mean, I think this whole piece of wise effort, has so many implications, because it's not, again, as I say, I think culturally, and I think particularly with the adoption of mindfulness into a lot of applications, there has become adopted a kind of imperative about stay with, and if you're not staying with, you're somehow failing. And actually, it's okay not to stay with sometimes when that is a conscious, intentional choice. Not a kind of, flight. When it's a conscious, intentional choice, it is sometimes the wisest thing to do, because it's in the service of cultivating the resources that allow us to stay with. If you've just had a big argument with your partner and stormed out of the room, if you've got that imperative to stay with, actually probably not the worst thing to do is to open that door again. Maybe actually you just need to cool out and understand what's going on. Come back to it. But this is true in many of our obsessional patterns too. It's not always wise to stay with. I even see it on another meditative level. Sometimes you see when people kind of deepen a lot in meditation practices, that often they're going into territory that can feel quite unknown and quite unfamiliar. And sometimes the response that arises is one of a sort of anxiety and fear, like my world is dissolving, I'm dissolving, I don't know what's going on. And people can feel this sort of arising of tremendous fear sometimes. And I would never give somebody the instruction, well, just stay with it. Just sit back off, it's okay. It's not like it's going to disappear. It's not like our obsession is going to be forgotten and we've missed this one golden moment to deal with it, But back off, recover, because you're not going to actually open to that deepening in the midst of fear. Better to calm the fear, to feel that confidence return. So I do think it's certainly an imperative to kind of soften a bit this idea of stay with. Yeah.
Can you say a little bit about with unwholesome actions or effort, so it results in this residue. You can see that, but then you can almost get this residue that comes from the fact that you generate some residue
Yes, that's going to be dependent upon how you respond to that residue, isn't it? Because, I mean, I think the residue, is that the kind of question?
How do you respond to it in a way that you don't create too much more residue?
No, you're absolutely right. Because, I mean, sometimes, you know, we do something unskillful or unhelpful. And, you know, if you have some sensitivity, you register the residues quite quickly, you know. If you do have a sort of ethical base, we register the residues of unskillfulness often very quickly. And as you say, sometimes what comes on the heels of that is this kind of reactivity of blame and aversion, you know, and I shouldn't have done that, and I should have known better, you know, or I do know better. So it's the way in which kind of the sort of the ethics or the value system of the Dharma has been co-opted by aversion, aversive selfing, you know, and it becomes a sort of new portfolio of standards, you know, about how I should be. So when really, actually, that second piece is probably the more important piece that to be aware of, because probably that reaction of aversion to residue is probably a very similar aversion that led to the unwholesome action in the first place. I mean, most unwholesome action does not, you know, arises out of aversion. Or, you know, or the fear aspect of aversion. So, by responding to the residue with aversion, it's very important to see that we're actually sort of, what we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. We're actually deepening that pattern of aversion. So there's something about our capacity to notice that. What is the difference between a sort of critical discernment, you know, that really says, you know, actually that really was unhelpful, and this other kind of much different tone of, you know, you really blew it, you're such a failure. You know, you can't do it. Completely different tones. You know, a critical discernment allows for a renewal of commitment. Okay? You know, I blew it. I really would have been better if I didn't say that, you know? So it allows for a renewal of commitment, a renewal of intentionality. And that allows for the completion of the residues. Huh? But the response of more aversion, there's no completion there. It spins round and round, and you can see how it opens the door for the 5 million times I've blown it, you know, and didn't live up to how I think I should be. You know, so that's actually the difference. It's not to abandon the critical discernment, which actually is in the spirit of deepening and growing and learning. But the aversion doesn't do any of that. It's a very different tone. But I think the renewal of intentionality, the renewal of commitment, is actually, it's a very different place than just floundering in the hopelessness of my imperfections. Don't get magical thinking. It may arise again, but it's not. But you actually, there's some sort of confidence that you've actually done what you're doing, what needs to be done. You know, it may arise again, but there's just a kind of more of a confidence. I know what needs to be done here. You know, which is that renewal of intentionality. The felt sense is entirely different. Yeah. I mean, I know some of you who work in professional environments where you're evaluated. This is a wonderful kind of exploration of this. I mean, you know, sometimes I teach for the National Health Service in England, you know, and I get evaluated, you know. It's a whole new experience for me. And I read the evaluation forms, and I find it so interesting, you know, to to read evaluation forms with the mind that says, oh, actually, they're right, you know. I actually could do this better, you know. And not read the evaluation forms with, ah, fantastic, yeah, I really did fantastic today. Because if I do that, piece of kind of self-affirmation and craving for approval, I'm going to do the failure piece to the equal degree. So, you know, that kind of discernment is actually not only in relationship to places where we stumble, it's also in relationship to the places where we grasp hold of, you know, approval and praise as being me. If we do that, we're going to do the other piece just the same.